Okay, so welcome to another episode of the Strength Training for Runners podcast. I'm joined by another guest today, and this time I'm joined by Josh Schofield from PGC1 Coaching. Josh has a strong background as an athlete himself. Throughout the age groups, he's achieved English schools medals over 1500 meters, an England athletics steeplechase title, Northern cross-country medalist at one point as well, and has 1500 meter PB of 3:52, 3000 meter PB of 8:22. So a very strong background as an athlete and academic qualifications to go alongside that as well, with a sports science degree from Leeds Beckett University and an MSc in nutrition from Loughborough. So a very strong background that's brought him into his coaching company, PGC1 Coaching. And the two of us both have a York connection as well. Josh grew up in York, ran for City of York. I've more recently moved to York. I've been based in York for the last 5 years. So our time in York hasn't crossed, but we both have that connection. So I thought we'd just kind of kick things off. Firstly, welcome, Josh. Thanks for coming on. But also, you know, maybe tell us, start off with a bit of background about your time in the sport, starting from those City of York days.
Thanks very much for having me on, Tim. Yeah, so I started at City of York AC back in 2009. So I started training with Ian Wilcox's training group at the time. And yeah, spent the first kind of, 6 years of my running career based at the old Huntington Stadium, which is where York Knights used to play. And then that's now the LNER football ground. Basically, I started off as a triathlete and my running had got quite weak out of the three sports. So my dad took me along to the athletics club, said, basically, you need to go and learn how to run fast. Put me in Ian's group. And then, the rest is history. Within 2 years of that, I'd won the London Mini Marathon and then I made my first English schools team. So kind of from there was where my love affair of running started.
Okay, very interesting. I didn't actually know about the triathlon background. So obviously you joined the running club, the athletics club, and became very successful as a runner in your own right. Did triathlon at some point take a back seat? Because obviously you did reach high levels of success as a runner, or were you continuing to compete as a triathlete during that time as well?
So the first couple of years I was at City of York, triathlon was still my main priority. So yeah, that it would have been 2010, 2011, 2012. Triathlon was the priority. And it was in 2012, I finished the triathlon season, just starting my GCSEs, and I kind of just felt like I wasn't really enjoying triathlon, where it was going. I felt like the journey that I had and the friends that I had in running, I preferred. And so decided to move into running kind of full time from there. So I still kept swimming and kept cycling a little bit kind of over the years still. But it was about 2012, I switched to solely focus on the running side of things.
Yeah, and I noticed, so obviously running did become the focus, but I noticed, I've seen as part of PGC1, there's a triathlon arm to the coaching business as well, isn't there?
Yes, there is, yeah. That's coordinated by Jack Bond, who really awesome guy, and is currently studying for a PhD at Loughborough as well.
Very good. So yeah, maybe we can touch on the triathlon training side possibly at some point. We'll just see where it develops and what we end up discussing. But that's definitely, obviously, you've got a strong knowledge on both running in its own right and triathlon. So something we can perhaps touch on. But first of all, we'll just get into your business, the crux of it a little bit. And obviously, let's start with the name PGC1. People, we've got a fairly knowledgeable listener base on the podcast. So some people that have knowledge on molecular exercise physiology, get my words out, might be familiar with PGC1. But there's obviously a reason behind the name. So let's start with that.
So yeah, so where the name came from, it comes from the molecule PGC1 alpha, which is the key regulator of aerobic metabolism. And as part of my final year university project, my dissertation centered on understanding the difference of measuring exercise economy with carbohydrate usage versus oxygen usage. And so throughout that, I was learning kind of the molecular pathway of, energy consumption. And the molecule PGC1 alpha just kept sticking out at me. And when I came up with the idea of I wanted to make my own coaching business, That was kind of the name I kept coming back from, and it just really stuck in my mind. So I Googled it, saw if anyone had it, and I was like, no one's got this. Brilliant. This is like revolutionary. This is definitely the best name for anything. And I kind of, I guess subconsciously, I always had the idea that I didn't want the name for my running coaching business just to be my name, because I felt like, you know, I wanted to make something bigger than just myself. So yeah, that I felt the name perfectly matched kind of what I wanted to do. And then also that filters in with the strap line really nicely, because for me, running coaching is about understanding the science, translating that, and then putting that into the art of coaching, of how you get the most out of someone. And it kind of fits in with the niche of all of our coaches. So we all come from, a university or sports science background, you know, have that appreciation of the theory of the sport. And then marry that up with the art of working with individuals and putting that into, you know, we've got people on our books who, you know, got published papers in sport and exercise science, all the way down to people who, you know, haven't picked up a book since school. So our journey is, and our, like, you know, passion is showing that that knowledge and helping everyone understand it and empower them.
Really good. Yeah. And just to pick on the fact that you mentioned you want the company to be bigger than just yourself as well. And you've got a good team with you working in the business now, haven't you? You mentioned Jack Bond already sort of leading up the triathlon arm, but I know that there's a bunch of other guys and girls, I think. Am I correct? Is Laura Waitman part of the team? Yeah. So
yeah, obviously, Laura Waitman is another one of our running coaches. We've got another running coach called Jack Foot. We've got three people who are kind of part of our online content and social media team. And then we've also got a data manager intern as well. So there's a team of eight of us now.
Very good, yeah. And so, yeah, that's quite a big coaching team by all accounts. So you've got a few different coaches, presumably, working. Is it a case of athletes kind of pick which coach they want to work with, or is it more of a collaborative thing where you all work together? How does that element work within the business?
So an athlete kind of inquires with PGT1, and then it will kind of come through me to as their head coach. I'll then do the initial consultation with the athlete. And then from there, we kind of give the option for them to select who they want to work with. Some of them say, I want to work with a female coach, some are like kind of a male coach. And then dependent on how busy kind of all of our kind of coaching rosters are at the time, I'll then kind of help match the athlete to the coach respectively.
Very good. And in terms of the business itself, is it a kind of a combination of online and in-person coaching? I guess you've got athletes from all over. So some of them, it's all delivered remotely. But I know you've got elements like your workout Wednesdays where you've got group sessions going on. And I know just before this call that we're on now, you were working with someone one-to-one. So how does that all fit together? Do people, some athletes receive an element of in-person and an element of online delivery, or is it very much on a case-by-case basis?
Yeah, it's a good mix and match. So we have our group sessions available, and obviously they're based down in the Midlands, so people can kind of jump in and out of them as they please. So we do coach a lot of people in the Northamptonshire area, and this is kind of, in terms of our geography, this is where most of our kind of clients are based. So yeah, they jump in the workouts with us. We then, yeah, do offer one-to-one sessions around that, subject to kind of scheduling. But then the main element of the business is delivered online. So it's delivered by a Training Peaks. So all of the athletes, their training plans are delivered to them, to their watches. And then, yeah, from there, there's kind of like add-ons to get more like personal or in-person coaching, one-to-one. But then the athletes that we don't necessarily see in person will then kind of, they'll get more like Zoom meetings, phone calls, messaging, etc. So it's a really hands-on approach. Wherever we are, well, wherever our athletes are in the country and in the world, you know, we'll try and be there for them as much as possible.
Yeah, and you mentioned Training Peaks as well. That's really like interactive and as well in a way, isn't it? You know, it's, I suppose interactive is the right word, but almost like instantaneous. You know, as soon as an athlete's performed their session, it'll be sort of within minutes, it's on Training Peaks and you can see what they've done, and vice versa. As soon as you've updated what you want them to do, they can kind of see it instantaneously. So that it's a really good platform, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it's awesome. Takes a little bit of getting used to, but yeah. Been doing it for long enough now that it kind of all works nice and easily and kind of simultaneously.
Yeah, I've had a look at, I mean, the bulk of my business is sort of in-person delivery, personal training, strength and conditioning, that kind of stuff. I've dabbled with Training Peaks with one or two people at points as well. And I know there's lots of metrics on there as well, isn't there? There's like in terms of training load and do you find those things quite useful? Are there any particular metrics that you kind of go to as your more useful sort of metrics that can guide training and how you approach that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we get a training load score, we get a fitness score, we get a fatigue score, and then like a form score. And they're probably the main metrics we use. I generally use those as like a retrospective training tool rather than kind of an in the moment training tool. Becomes a part of the bigger picture of the coaching plan, and it's kind of an element that we use. But I would say as I first started my coaching journey, I was very data driven, and that would kind of try and prove to myself or prove to the athlete that the training was working. But as I've gained more experience, the data has kind of become a less integral role, more of a supporting role. The thing is with the watches, they are so temperamental, and the filters and settings on Training Peaks have to be perfect in order for it to, you know, work correctly. You then even get to the point, if someone changes watch halfway through a training block, their training loads change completely. So try not to rely on the data too much. Just kind of, we use it and look at it retrospectively. So after our marathon blocks, we'll go through and do a big data analysis project, and we'll look at the training history and look how the fitness scores changed over time, and see if we can kind of find a relationship between, you know, the sessions that have been completed and then performance at the end. But we don't necessarily look for causal and effectual links at all. Just with the way that the data is only as good as the watch or the person that's kind of, you know, using the, making the data themselves. So yeah, some of it is really, really good. Other parts of it, you know, don't necessarily work too well. And then you've now got like stride pods that people use, and that just sends it all out, because then it's the thresholds are based on the wattage put through the foot rather than the you know, the lactate threshold. And so it all becomes very, very complicated.
Yeah. That's a really interesting perspective, actually, just kind of considering the error element, I guess. You know, there's going to be a large element of error depending on the factors you mentioned. You know, someone changes their watch, or just the GPS errors due to connections or issues or what have you. So what you were saying in terms of looking at it more, I guess, on a macro level, so you can see bigger picture trends and not getting too bogged down in the sort of day-to-day acute stuff is very interesting. So I think that's really a good way to look at it. If we kind of switch a little bit to more that like the hands-on stuff, the in-person stuff a little bit as well, because I know you provide things like lactate testing as part of the surface as well. So we can discuss other aspects of the in-person stuff as well, but if we maybe start with that talk a little bit like about how you use that lactate testing and how that informs your training as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So the lactate testing is all like delivered by our PGC1 tri coach, Jack Bond. So with his kind of work in the physiology field through his master's and postgraduate doctorship, he's done a lot of work with like lactate testing. So we use that as a really, really good training tool. So what he'll do is he'll put them through a range of paces and do kind of a step incremental lactate test, builds a really nice report for us. And then that lactate threshold value we get, that then is kind of inputted into Training Peaks, and we then plan the training in and around that. So in terms of philosophy wise, like I will look at working on the threshold element of training probably at least once a week with all of my athletes. Tends to be that most of the guys I work with, or guys and girls, are 5K upwards generally. So therefore we kind of try and keep touch base with the threshold side of things on a weekly basis. Even my kind of 8-1500 runners, I'll still try and get some threshold in each week. So that number is really important, because it gives me kind of that, I can match up, well, what does the lactate data say versus like, what does their racing data say? And then gives me a bit clearer picture as to like, what zone should they be in? And what I'm, you know, really hot on the fact of like, that's your maximum value. So one of the girls, her maximum value for a threshold was 7:02 a mile. So it's a case of you come on the track and do tempo, you don't run any quicker than 146, no matter what the conditions, because we need to be underneath the curve in order to be able to be developing that lactate threshold to be able to get it higher. So it's a really good way of just monitoring where the athlete's at and giving them kind of performance almost limits in training, so that we're touching the right zones rather than them pushing themselves in a threshold session to go under that 7 minute mile marker, because you know they can, and then ending up being not in the kind of quite the correct training zone. We end up in a non-functional reaching over state, and they're not improving because they're actually just putting too much work in for the reward back out.
And in terms of like measuring that threshold and then using it as a guide for training paces as well, do you because there's a variety of different thresholds, like physiologically speaking, that we can measure. There's things like lactate threshold itself, lactate turning point. There's various maximum lactate steady state, which is probably similar to and sometimes people traditionally have used like a value of 4 millimoles, I think, as a sort of proxy for lactate threshold. But also more recently, I guess, in terms of what's trendy right now, like with the Norwegian method and double threshold training days, obviously as part of that Norwegian method, they do a lot of thresholds monitoring to make sure they're under certain levels. And the values that seem to be used as a threshold marker that they want to stay under seem to be much lower, from what I understand anyway, than these traditional, that, you know, like, for example, if 4 millimoles is traditionally a proxy for lactate threshold, I think we're often seeing like values of around 2 millimoles they're trying to stay under and stuff like that. What do you kind of view as a suitable threshold, or is there any one of those particular areas that you sort of use with your testing as such, if that all makes sense?
Yeah, so our testing, we use the first deflection of the curve, second deflection of the curve. Yeah. The first LT1, so that would be similar to like a maximum lactate steady state.
Yeah.
That would be like marathon effort-ish for most people. And then the second deflection of the curve, we would term as lactate threshold 2. I guess like the top end of their tempo zone. That's what we would define it as. From a theory base, it's really interesting, like the Norwegian method. And I think actually an area that a lot of people have gone wrong is thinking that you've got to be at 4 millimoles to see any improvement in your lactate threshold. And actually, it's the work below that is really crucial, because you're still in that aerobic zone. And you're able to accumulate more work and then bag the work the next day and the day after as well. And that's where like the lactate stuff's really interesting, because as I say, it gives us that kind of almost limiting factor. It's like, we don't go over this pace. So that means that we can get more done in session. And then we can get them back out running the next day, back in doing a session, you know, the same week, et cetera, and build that bigger overall training history, because no one session that they complete is ever going to improve them. It's about the accumulation of, you know, getting every workout in possible. And one thing that I'm kind of always minded to kind of go back to with my own training philosophy is, there's a really good study from the Australian Institute of Sport that showed if you hit over 90% of the planned training in any one block, you're 7 times more likely to achieve your goal. So for me, it's the case of consistency always outweighs kind of any one standout session. So really hammering home that element of, I want to see 16 to 20 weeks of everything green, everything looking the same, and then we'll see the big kind of whole improvement, rather than almost like those small little sessional improvements, but then that doesn't help the overall picture.
Yeah, like absolutely emptying the tank in a particular session just to try and get an improvement on the last session. But what are the consequences of that? You know, are you suffering in the following session because you're not fully recovered, and you know, thinking about the longer term picture as well. And also just I think we may have just broken up a little bit while you're explaining those thresholds a little bit. So I'll just kind of recap and just check we're on the right lines there. So you were saying sort of you measure two different thresholds, that sort of a threshold one and a threshold two, if you like. Obviously we're at two different levels. And so I guess the first threshold is when is it when lactate rises, but initially, but then doesn't continue to rise at that point? And then the second point would be where it rises and continues to exponentially rise, essentially. So you've got two different intensities that result in those two different sort of observations with the readings.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, very good. So I can imagine, you know, that's really appealing to a lot of athletes, having that level of support, you know, because most coaching companies out there are not going to be able to provide that, you know, whether it's having the technical ability to do the testing or just the knowledge behind it, you know. So that's certainly something that sets you apart. And I know you've got quite a few high level athletes on the books as well. I'm thinking, you know, in terms of both of our York connections, I know Tommy Shaw, very good middle distance guy, sort of 1500 3K type guy. He's on your coaching books, isn't he? And I think there's a whole range of guys that operate in that kind of level, from maybe like 800 meters right up to the marathon. I think you've got like a 229 marathon guy as well, possibly, something like that.
Oh yeah, George Phillips.
Yeah. So you've got some quality athletes. So I don't know what, if we can maybe get your thoughts on what's attracted sort of that caliber athlete to yourselves. Is it because you can have that kind of service that other people don't have, or is it your background in your sport? What I guess just your own ideas on what's made you sort of one of the go-to guys out there for some of the higher level people.
Yeah, good question. It might be best to ask them. I think so my first ever athlete that I had was George Phillips, and we started working together whilst he was at York Uni and I was at Leeds Beckett. So George and I have had a really, really strong relationship for a long, long time, and we just clicked really well together. The best thing about working with George is they really buy into the kind of training rationale that I've come up with over the years. And our ideologies match really nicely. And straight away, when I started working with them, I could see where we could make those little improvements. And then year on year, we've just built and built and built and built. So we literally started running 40 miles a week 5-6 years ago. The next year is 50, 60, and steadily built up over that time. And that George's investment in me as his coach and that learning I've gained from it, I think that is kind of how I've then started to work with higher level athletes. So I know that Tommy, when he started working with me, that was down to the success that George had under myself. And some of the other higher level athletes working with, that's through things like working on the youth talent program. And for me, my focus and my key thing is that I work directly with the person. So I'm not going, as a performance coach, outcome is largely irrelevant to me. What I want to do is empower the athlete that I've got in front of me to nail the process of all of their racing so that they can go onto the racetrack, whether that be the road, the cross country, or the athletics track, and go and give the maximum out of themselves. And I think that the way that my kind of personality works, that's how athletes have come to my door, because they can kind of see that vision that I've got for them. And I just want to be here to empower those athletes and help them get the most out of themselves. So yeah, it's not a case of like, there's 10 sessions a year that I give the athletes, and, you know, I've got some kind of different physiological training plan to anyone else that makes me any better than anyone else. So I think what for me I do slightly differently is I really try and understand the athlete and what makes them tick and what are their strengths and weaknesses, and really help them navigate that racing sphere of how do I best execute my own strength in order to get the most out of myself. So for example, like Dexter Thompson's a young lad that I work with up in Blackburn, and he just ran the National Indoor 1500 meter final for under 20s. We went into the race and I said, you know, Dex, like, your strength is the fact of you could kick at 500 meters to go and run 27-27 for last 200s. So go and do that and go and put yourself in a position where you're able to do that. And he executed the race plan near perfectly, just unfortunately got dipped at the line and came second rather than won the race. But, you know, it wasn't necessarily about we did this 200 session, or we did, you know, 4x1K and then some 400s, and that was what made the difference. It was kind of the messaging and how we talk, and giving the athletes an environment where they can go out and be their best self, be empowered to do that, but not fear the consequences if it doesn't quite get like come off. Because I think a lot of athletes run scared as to, well, I don't want a bad race. And in doing so, they never have a good race. So I'll always try and empower the athletes so they can have the best race possible. And then, you know, if it doesn't quite go right, well, let's have a look at the plan and let's execute it better next time.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a few things we can probably unpick there, but I really, in terms of the process versus the outcome stuff, I don't know. Do you follow Steve Magnus at all? He talks a lot about that, and I really buy into that element. But I guess to simplify it, some of what you were saying as well, you're invested in them as a person as much as anything, rather than the result. Which obviously they appreciate and they value, and that's been part of your success. And also, you know, just the story of how it all got started. I guess that's quite a common story amongst coaching as well. Something that springs to mind, maybe like someone like James Thee, who I think his first athlete was Dave Bishop, who just approached him. I think they did training together because James was still competing at a high level at the time. And then obviously he got good results with Dave Bishop. He didn't necessarily have plans to go into coaching, but he got great results with him. And then other people started approaching him, and then the rest is history kind of thing. And so I guess that's a similar scenario that's happened with you in a way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I had a couple of people I was working with before I started PGC1, and they seemed to keep getting better and hit PBs. And so I was like, okay, well, you know, maybe this is a viable career pathway for me. At the time, I was about to start a master's at Loughborough. I didn't have enough money to get to and from Loughborough because I only had £100 left over from my student loan to after the course fee was taken out to get to and from university. So it was a case of, well, I need to do something, and I wanted at least a flexible job to allow me to be able to do my uni course and work at the same time. And so that's where the idea for the coaching company started. And then it kind of snowballed from there. And I was really fortunate that a couple of local athletes to where I'm based now very early on got involved. We started a group session on a Wednesday. That kind of snowballed. And then from there, like that's where it all, and through word of mouth and the results that we were gaining, that's when it, yeah, all kind of started to become a full-time job.
Brilliant. Yeah, fantastic story. And also, we've covered a lot of ground with the training stuff as well. But if we maybe shift a little bit of focus, because obviously this is the Strength Training for Runners podcast. So if, you know, kind of just talk a little bit along the strength and conditioning side of things as well, get your viewpoint on that. What kind of input you have with your athletes or as part of the coaching process there? Is it, I'll just keep it general. Do you have any viewpoints generally on how you integrate strength and conditioning within the programs, if at all, of course?
I think strength and conditioning is it's a really interesting area and such a complex area as well. And what I think that a lot of runners tend to do is they tend to think that they go quite simplistic with how they think about it. They go, I need to do strength training, so I'm going to go into the gym, I'm going to do deadlifts, I'm going to do squats, and I'm going to do some bench press, and that's going to make me a better runner. And I think for me, my passion and my vision of how S&C works, it's about how do the fundamental movements of strength relate to a running form and making it very sport specific. I think there's a reference somewhere that I can kind of gain from my head. It could even be Berg 2003, something like that. He says, why do runners do back squats when you never have a weight behind your shoulders when you run and you never have 2 feet on the ground? So how does that movement relate then to a running movement? And of course, obviously, you know, building up the greater hip, glute, quad, hamstring, calf strength, you know, being stronger in all those areas does help the running form, absolutely. But for me, it's kind of like, well, how can I make my athletes move better? How can I make them move more efficiently? So I tend to, with kind of the facilities I've got available to me and my qualifications, I tend to go down a really drills-focused route. So I work with a lot of younger athletes down at the local athletics club here. And, you know, the first year that I was there, it was basically just getting their drills right was the focus on all of the sessions. and, you know, being really good at the fundamentals. Can they A drill? Can they B skip? You know, what does their foot placement look like? Getting them to run over wickets so that, you know, they know how to drive their knees. And that kind of forms the fundamental basis of their conditioning element for me. And, you know, I see my role as the coach is to, I need to get the athlete conditioned enough that they can do the drills really well. They're strong and they're efficient with how they move. And then I can start to work with a specific strength and conditioning coach to help the other elements, because strength and conditioning is so specialized to each individual athlete and the knowledge is so specialized. I don't provide that myself because I can't be in the gym with them every time they're doing it. And, you know, the intricacies of, you know, how different exercises work, that's a better place for a strength and conditioning coach. So, you know, for example, like Tommy and Dexter, both of them have specific strength and conditioning coaches. So I'll liaise with them and be like, this is the program. This is what we're aiming for, longer term, shorter term. And then we kind of communicate together as to how the S&C then fits in and around the running side of things. But yeah, my big emphasis is on that, you know, the whatever they're doing, it's got to be sustainable. You know, the lifting is about strengthening. It's not about trying to, like, you know, be as big as you can in the gym. You're not trying to get, you know, beach weights ready. And, you know, making it relatable to running. How does the exercise that you are going to complete in the gym, how does that, you know, make you a better runner?
Yeah, very good. Very good. Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few things I think we can really unpick from your perspectives on strength and conditioning there. And I very much agree with everything you've said there. But if we start with the drills aspect, and I definitely think people don't appreciate how much they actually have a strong strength and conditioning component to them. Obviously, we review them as just a technical thing, you know, I guess ingraining good running form, of which that is that obviously an element to why we do them. But there's definitely a strong sort of strength and conditioning stimulus that can be gained from them in terms of developing power, stiffness, reactivity, those kinds of qualities. Because they obviously, when you start in a very sort of basic manner, you know, with the A marches and such, it's very low load. But when you progress to sort of A skips, B skips, and more type bounding type variations, you know, they are plyometric in late nature. You're producing force, you're absorbing impact, and that all provides an important S&C type stimulus. So I think absolutely in terms of starting along those lines, you know, you get great benefits from that. And I think another element as well, we mentioned Steve Magnus a while ago, and I think this is something he's often talked about, you know, the like maximum effort hill sprints, sort of 10 second efforts, that kind of thing with a slow walk back recovery, you know, not very much of it, but you know, you're really recruiting the neuromuscular system there, and it's training a lot of qualities that you can that you might be looking to develop in the gym anyway. So that's another area that people can look at without necessarily requiring the expertise of a strength and conditioning coach as well. I don't know what your thoughts are on the hill sprints and whether that's something you incorporate at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of what you were saying there reminds me of a Gino De Campo quote. If you've ever watched Gino, Gordon and Fred, where he goes, he talks about minimum effort, maximum satisfaction. And, you know, I think that kind of really relates to exactly what we're both saying, is that, you know, with drills, you can get, like, it's a really low hanging fruit where you can get huge amounts of physiological and strength benefit without having to go and spend, you know, 45 minutes, you know, competing to get a barbell in a gym and, you know, pay a huge membership to go and be able to go and lift weights. And so, you know, for the fundamental of how you start is, you know, it's a really, really important thing. And yeah, I think that building in things like hill sprints is, again, a really good way of just developing those neurological pathways of how do I drive that knee? How do I get the knee back on the floor or the foot back on the floor quickly and then transfer that power? Because it's all about that transference of power. You know, as endurance athletes, we want to lose as little power as possible, as much as possible. So, you know, can we, by increasing that maximum, obviously we then power element. You then, you know, use less in theory each time you put the foot on the floor. But, you know, making that efficiency of how do you generate power and then continue to maintain it rather than having to always be on the gas generating power. You know, that's the really kind of fundamental thing for me. And it's about, you know, how can we microdose it? Because lifting weights is really, really hard and it beats the body up. So how can we microdose strength training across the week with everything that we do in order to not have to do the really big high spikes of training load? Because when we get into that high spike, that's the risk point of, is a niggle going to present itself? Is illness going to present itself? You know, excessive fatigue or, you know, mental fatigue as well, and boredom with the training because you're having to go that hard. So can we take some of that load off by doing some of the basics right? And I think the biggest thing is doing everything with purpose. So the best place that I've ever done these drills is in the high pack center at Loughborough, because when we do it with the YTP kids, the sprinters warm up at the same time, and the way you hear their feet hit the floor and they really drive through the floor, you think, you go, that they're doing every single drill with purpose and to practice that force element. So for me, the biggest thing I always kind of, you know, say to my athletes is, I want to hear that force going through your foot and you, you know, using that and you know, generating force and then rebounding that force back off the ground. And it's about, drills are not just, you know, something where we kind of go just to sort of do them to warm up. They're an integral part of the session and they're as important as the workout you're about to do. And every drill is done with purpose and executed technically correctly. And then if you can do that, you can, I think, you know, access the kind of harder or higher hanging fruit of the gym, and you'll gain more from it because you've already got that really strong technical component.
Absolutely. Let's just touch on what you said about the microdosing element as well, sort of spreading smaller amounts of it throughout the week rather than one big session, which takes a lot out of you and is harder to recover from. And also that ties in my opinion, a little bit with what you're talking about in terms of training with purpose, because different elements of strength and conditioning kind of can provide different purposes. And some of the drills or the hill sprints or maybe certain plyometric type activities, you know, one purpose of them could actually be almost like a potentiating type stimulus where it's going to improve subsequent performance in an acute way, whether that's part of a warm-up, drills in a warm-up for a subsequent track session, or even maybe a few hill sprints the day before a big session, because it fires up the nervous system and you actually feel a little bit better for it. You've not done enough to really fatigue yourself, but you've really switched everything on. So you and the same could be achieved with, you know, certain plyometric exercises or something like that. So where you position certain things within the training week can influence the sort of effect you achieve from them. And on the other hand, I guess other aspects of strength and conditioning, you know, if you're trying to develop a particular tissue in order to develop a level of robustness, because I don't know, you want stronger glutes because your hamstrings keep on getting strained, just as an example, then you might need to put a bit more volume through that tissue. And so that might want to be placed at a different point in the week, maybe just after a hard session, because you don't want that work you're doing to the fatigue from it to interfere with the running session. So we can, I guess, like put, you know, certain elements before a session because it has a potentiating effect, certain elements after a session because it's going to be more fatiguing and we don't want to carry that fatigue into our main running sessions as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So yeah, that's excellent input there. Do you have any other, in terms of what you were saying, in terms of the movement that we select and individualizing that as well, I guess, you know, in terms of individualizing to the athlete as well, you know, some athletes are stronger than others. Some athletes have more of a history of doing that kind of stuff than others as well. So that's going to massively influence, you know, the volumes you give them and the intensity you give them, and whether, you know, you do, like you were saying, load them with a bar on their back, or whether you just do body weight stuff and all sorts of stuff. Because we can, you know, you can get a lot of conditioning benefit from fairly simple body weight exercise as well, you know, glute bridges and probably body weight lunges and things like that. in the first instance is for someone who's very weak and hasn't done much in the first place, that that's going to be a sufficient strengthening stimulus and they probably don't even need to set foot in the gym.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's about understanding each athlete and their own sort of, you know, technical components. And it's understanding that there isn't just one way to run and, you know, there in terms of running form. And it's about not looking at trying to get every athlete running the exact same, because there is no perfect running technique. But, you know, there are certain parameters that we need to think about. So, for example, where does the foot land in or relation to where the center of mass is on impact? And if the further that foot is away from the body, the more loading is going to go through that foot. That's then kind of highlights a more of a red flag for an injury risk down the line. So how can I get that athlete moving in a more efficient manner so that they can absorb load more often? And through England Athletics, there's a really, really good framework that we use in the YTP on like kind of almost like an ABC principle of like, you know, where we should be landing in relation to our body, where our, you know, what should our upper bodies be doing, where should our head position be, etc. And we use that to kind of help runners kind of understand their technical demands a little bit better. But yeah, absolutely. It's about understanding where the athlete is in that journey. What is the, first of all, like, what's their long-term aim, medium-term aim, short-term aim? What's their training history? What's their injury history like? And then from there, gaining that greater picture, you can then give that more individualized program from that kind of standpoint. Because, you know, that the marathon runners that I coach, a lot of them have children or they have long-term partners. They have highly stressful jobs. Trying to get them in to go and do a specific strength and conditioning session every week isn't always that achievable. So, you know, that gets us back to that micro-dosing element of, well, how can we access strengthening each of those areas but fit it into the lives that they've got? Because, you know, unfortunately, not every athlete can be professional. You know, it's a shame that they can't be. But, you know, it's you know, understanding that holistic approach with the athlete and their whole life, and how can we get everything we need into that athlete, but then also make it an achievable training schedule, because I'm sure both of us could write the most perfect S&C plan up to any kind of, you know, given event, but if the athlete isn't able to go and complete half of it, then it's not worth putting in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think cover the nail there on the head, you know, really, there's two elements to it, isn't it? There's, you know, we put this here because of this reason, and we put that there because of that reason. But also, what's the athlete's life like? Because if they can't do it, then it's irrelevant. And so that definitely needs to be taken into consideration as well. I think we've covered loads of ground there. I don't know, do you want to touch on anything that I've not asked you? Or was there any, I think we've covered a lot, to be honest.
Yeah, I think we've kind of covered a very large amount of running there. Maybe I guess we could kind of touch on a little bit of what PGC1 do a little bit more. So yeah, so in terms of PGC1 and what we are, so we're an online predominantly training company. We deliver online bespoke training plans for any distance. So we've got athletes from 800, 1500 meter runners all the way up to, you know, marathon, ultra marathon runners. And our remit is that we're working directly with each individual athlete to give them the best plan that's going to allow them to hit whatever their kind of short, medium-term goal is. But then beyond that, we want to keep working with them to keep bettering them as a person. And our kind of vision our key kind of performance indicator as a coaching team that I instill in our coaches is that we want every athlete to enjoy their running journey. And we want every athlete to, once they finish their time with PGC1, to still love their running, take the lessons that they've learned from us, and then keep applying those so they can keep getting better and better. So yeah, it's going to deliver through Training Peaks, as we spoke about before. We also offer some in-person sessions. So on a Wednesday night in Daventry, Northamptonshire, we've got a Workout Wednesday session where we just kind of do a pretty general track session that most endurance runners can join in and access and get some training benefit from. We take that out on the road as well a little bit. So we have done a couple of sessions in London and we're looking to do a few more on the road again this year. And yeah, so we are, you can find us on Instagram at PGC1 Coaching, and you can find me on Instagram, Josh Schofield 1098, or our website is www.pgc1coaching.com. Fire in an online inquiry, and then yeah, we can get chatting to you and hopefully help you with your running journey.
Brilliant. Perfect. Thank you. Summed up the business really well there. And guys, you know where to find Josh and PGC1. So if you like the sound of what is said in this particular episode, make sure you get in touch and start leveling up, I guess, and take your running to the next level and enjoy it as well. Enjoy it as well. Yeah. Thanks for coming on. It's been really, really insightful, really great discussion. I've really enjoyed it. Yeah. So thanks again, Josh.
No, my pleasure. Thanks, Tim.